This is CliffCentral.com.
Well, it's always terrific to have foreign diplomats in the studio with us because we get to find out a little bit about some of the countries that South Africa has relations with, some of the countries that are intimately involved in what South Africa is doing. And this morning is absolutely no exception to that. It's a country that I think very many people in the world love, want to go to, want to know more about. And this morning, His Excellency, Mr. Liam McGowan. How do I pronounce it first?
McGowan.
They told me that, but I
B-H
couldn't.
B-H is silent.
Well, yeah. I couldn't believe it when I saw how it was written. McGowan, M-A-G-G-A-B-H-A-N-N.
Yeah.
The Ambassador to Ireland.
Good morning.
Ireland. How are you, sir?
I'm very good.
Thank you
for inviting me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. I was remiss to not have invited you before. You've been in South Africa since 2014.
Yeah, over 4 years now.
Having a good time still?
Yeah, really enjoying it. It's one of the most interesting postings I've ever had.
Well, you've been to Malawi.
I was in Malawi between 2007, 2011, and then went back to the Foreign Ministry in Dublin and was Director for Sub-Saharan Africa in the Foreign Ministry for 3 years. Which gave me a good understanding of the Southern Africa region. So when the opportunity came up for a posting to South Africa, I immediately applied and I was lucky enough to get it.
Well, I'm sure that you wouldn't have chosen to come here if you weren't interested in the place and didn't do something for you. But having been here for a couple of years now, almost 5 years, there must be some things about South Africa that you absolutely love, that you're very pleased about, and there must be some things that you were surprised by.
I think the issues that pleased me most were the people, the friendliness of the people, the beauty of the country. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful countries you can imagine. The climate. I mean, yeah. I come from a country where we are used to cold weather, we're used to damp weather, we're used to rain.
It's raining now.
It's raining. And you come to a country like South Africa where the climate is absolutely spectacular, and which gives you really the opportunity to get out there, have an outdoors life, see a lot of things. I mean, it's the beauty of the country, including its people, that really struck me.
But Ireland is so magnificent. You must sometimes miss the green. I mean, it's just perfect year round.
I mean, no matter how many years I've been away, Ireland is always my home. Yeah. I always look at it as my home. And that's where my family is. And that's where we love to go back to. And when I eventually do retire, it's where I'll go back to live.
But Ireland is so beautiful that it's the scene of so many of the movies that we think when they do these historical pictures, they have to go to Ireland to get an idea of what the world must have looked like when it was unspoilt.
That's
and
right.
Before people had ruined it, and it was green and it was lush and it was real. And I suppose that's one of the reasons it's so charming to people who are not from there.
Yeah.
Do you find when you're in Ireland, people there sort of take it for granted?
I think we do take it very much for granted. Like I've talked about the beauty of South Africa, and I was posted in China for a few years. I talk about the beauty of China. And sometimes when I go back to my own country, I remind myself, wow, I mean, this is a beautiful country. You go even just outside Dublin down to the County Wicklow, which is south of Dublin, and the beauty of County Wicklow. But then you go to the west of Ireland. Wow. And then Ireland is such a small country. I mean, you can get to any part of the country within a couple of hours to experience that beauty. Yeah, you have to remind yourself. And it's not just the scenery, it's also the history, the culture, the universities. It's the we're a changed country. I mean, it's a country that's evolved very much over the last 20, 30 years. So the Ireland that people might think of as a conservative rural country is very changed.
Well, it's incredible. I mean, Ireland's history really, you know, you can go all the way back, but as a country, it's 100 and something years.
Yeah.
And an incredible amount of change that the people of Ireland have had to experience over those decades.
Right, yeah.
I mean, if you were in the 1920s, in Ireland, you wouldn't recognize many of the things that we now take for granted. It's a sovereign state. It's got its own culture and language and people. And a lot of that stuff obviously comes from a long time before. But Ireland's been through all kinds of trials and tribulations. And people tend to forget because we look at Ireland now and we see it as this this incredibly evolved place where there are, you know, where Ireland's economy surged and then kind of came down. And, you know, it was one of the places where people were most excited to start tech businesses and all the rest of it. Yeah. But just a little while ago, it really was quite a rural place. And not so long before that, there were things like the potato famine, which almost wiped out the majority of the Irish population. I mean, the people of Ireland have had a tough time over the years.
We're a very resilient people. I mean, in the middle of the 19th century, the population of Ireland was 8.5 million. And thence we had the Great Famine. And between the 1840s, 1850s, and the end of the 19th century, our population reduced from 8.5 million to 3.5 million. We lost 5 million people through famine, but mostly through emigration because of the poverty levels that existed. And many of our Irish at that time emigrated to the United States, emigrated to the United Kingdom, emigrated to Australia and other countries.
This is where we talk about the Irish diaspora.
Which is really, really important to us. And Irish people, I mean, we, through our history lessons in school, we learn about that history. We learn about the where we've come from. And it matters to us.
Well, it informs the character of so much of what makes the country what it is. And certainly resilience is one of the words that people would use. But also character, humor, the kind of people who have, they're not miserable about their lives. They really are some of the most. A friend of mine just went to Ireland a short while ago, and I saw him incidentally over the weekend, and he hasn't been to any other countries in Europe. He loves Ireland. He said Dublin is one of the most friendly, wonderful, welcoming, warm places he's been to. And almost in stark contrast to the weather, the Irish people have a tremendous reputation all over the world.
It's funny, you mentioned the 1920s there, and we got our independence in 1921, and it was a very difficult time for Ireland. We had our own civil war at that stage in the early 1920s. But the Irish people, many stories have been written about that period and many films produced. And what has always struck me about the Irish during that very difficult period was, as you say, the humour, the wit. Mm-hmm. We have the Dublin wit, as we call it. People were very articulate, you know, and we had the Dublin accent, which is very different
people
from
love
your
it.
Accent.
Yeah.
And people accepted, you know, the situation they were in and made the most of it. And it, even though it was a very, very tough life, and the evolution of Ireland since the 1920s has been absolutely profound. And even up to the 1950s, 1960s, we were seen as a conservative, small-scale agricultural country with no economy of any note. And really, in the 1960s then, the really big decision, the visionary decisions were made about what type of Ireland do we want to be for our people. So we had very good leaders at that time. So they made a couple of big decisions, like joining the European Union, which provides a market of 550 million people as opposed to just 4 million people.
Yeah.
We invested very substantially in our education system. And we developed a country that's friendly to foreign investment. They were the three key decisions that were made. But it took really 20, 25 years for the benefits of those visionary decisions to manifest themselves within four Irish people. I remember going to school in the 1960s. I was one of the first beneficiaries of free secondary school education because of that one of those visionary decisions. And, you know, Irish people today, we have about 60 to 65% of our young people coming out with third level qualifications. But it's not just any third level qualifications. Our education system is built around the needs of the economy. So when we attract investment, as we do a lot of, from particularly from the United States, but also now from Asia, from India, from China, from Japan, and also from the European Union, we're able to provide the skills from within the country. So as a result now, we've effectively got full employment.
That's incredible.
And that's the way the country has evolved on the economic front. And I can talk as well about how it's evolved on the social front.
Absolutely. Yeah,
we've had effectively...
We could do with some of those lessons in South Africa so we don't have to replicate them ourselves at great expense and pain, the things we can learn.
Yeah, we've had a social revolution in Ireland in the last 20, 25 years from a time when Contraception was illegal. Divorce was illegal.
It was very much the influence of the Catholic Church. The fact that the Catholic Church at that and before the 1960s, they were completely responsible for education
too,
in Ireland, right?
And I think, you know, we very often criticize the Catholic Church for some of the wrongs that have happened. But I always remind people that without the Church, a lot of us would not have achieved an education. And we received an extremely good education from the Church going back over the years. And I see the contribution that a lot of the Catholic missionaries now make in South Africa and indeed in the broader Southern Africa region, where without them, a lot of people would not have been educated, would not have had proper health systems. But going back to Ireland, you know, the country has evolved. That conservatism that would have existed over many, many decades has now effectively disappeared. And now people haven't necessarily lost their faith, but it's much more than just an institutional faith now. Well, it's more a personal faith.
Yeah,
for people.
And people, I suppose, have become more individually sovereign.
Yes.
You know, they're able to espouse liberal or conservative views as they like.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
able to pick and choose at what things they'd like to say yes to and what things they'd like to say no to, which I suppose is the very definition of freedom then.
And then, I mean, you see the types of changes that have taken place, and these are all changes to our constitution, because the social framework of Ireland was set in our constitution. So there have been many changes to that constitution over the years. So now we have marriage equality in Ireland, where anybody can marry. And that happens.
Would have been unthinkable 20 years ago.
20 years ago, when homosexuality would have been illegal.
Yeah.
So now, and that was voted on by the Irish people. And some suggest that it was predominantly the younger people. But in fact, it was a cross-section of Irish people, older people as well, that knew young gay people and were saying, why shouldn't they have the opportunity to live an open life and love each other and marry each other?
So on that note, what are the misconceptions that you often have to allay, not just for people in South Africa, but through the course of your time in the diplomatic service and elsewhere? I saw that you'd been at the World Bank and EU. So what are the things that people think about Irish people that are just not true or about Ireland?
Well, I think there's an incredible recognition now of that evolution that has taken place because it was world news. I mean, I remember looking at CNN News the day of the marriage equality referendum was passed, the day the abortion referendum was passed. These issues got, because of the conservative nature of Ireland, the historic conservatism that exists in Ireland, these issues went out to the whole world. And so I have found that anywhere I go, there's a recognition within these countries
of
what changes have taken place.
Yeah.
So I don't really have to start back and explain, you know, where we've come from. You know, I just have to explain why this change has taken place, why the people voted for these changes. Because I think sometimes we forget that the changes that are occurring in Ireland are voted on by the people of Ireland. They're not changes simply just introduced by government. They're actually changes that needed to be made to our constitution.
It's like a groundswell of public support, and then the politicians have to respond.
Yeah, and it's a very, people took it very personally, whether it was gay marriage or marriage equality,
abortion,
contraception, divorce.
Sure.
People knew friends, family members, they were all caught up by this.
Mm. Made it personal.
And they made it personal, and this is why the changes occurred.
I'm curious about how you got involved in public service, because it's not something that a lot of people happen upon early in their lives. I think a lot of people decide to become, you know, dutiful or of public service later on in life. But you sort of studied that. You studied public administration,
that's
right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What got you interested in being in government or in public service or in the diplomatic corps?
I think when I left school in the 1970s, early 1970s, I immediately went into the public sector as what we call an executive officer. And then I did
trade and commerce, right?
Yeah, I worked in an economic ministry. And I did my degree at night and did public administration at night. And at that time, my family, the university was costly, and my family couldn't afford to send me to college. So I paid my own way.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in that field and got promoted up the line in that field for about 20 years. And then I decided that I would like a change. So about 25 years ago, I decided that the diplomatic field was something that I would like to try. And I was able to enter into the diplomatic service. And I felt that the contribution I wanted to make as a public servant, I had had a lot of experience of working in Ireland, contributing to public services within Ireland. But I felt that I would like to try in contributing my skills, my experience outside of Ireland to the development of Ireland. We call it the prosperity of Ireland. So how could I do that? So I felt joining the diplomatic corps was the next step in my career to try and achieve that. And I've never regretted that decision. It's been a fantastic decision.
It's taken you to some very interesting places. Jordan.
Jordan, yeah.
Among others.
I spent 6 months in Jordan working in a World Bank project in the financial services sector. Incredible experience. Every posting I've had, I've enjoyed. You make the most of everywhere. I mean, I was in China between 2003 and 2007 when the country was evolving so quickly as a huge economy.
And what a time to witness that stuff.
And it was a wonderful experience. And then I worked in Brussels in our representation to the European Union before that.
Now, people in Brussels get a lot of scorn from those, especially these movements now that we see gaining traction all over Europe, these anti-EU movements. They always talk about the bureaucrats of Brussels in a pejorative sense. I mean, what's it like being in Brussels, and what kind of things get discussed, and what are those people really like? I mean, give us the alternate view to the constant criticism we hear from everybody else.
But again, for me, when we think about the European Union, we have to think back as to why the European Union was established initially. And it was established as a peace project to try and make sure that the countries that were fighting each other over many years would never do so again.
Many centuries.
Yeah. So that was the initial project around which the European Union, or the European Economic Community, as it was called then, was built. And there were six original members, those countries that were part of those centuries of conflict. Mm. And it's gradually developed ever since. And for me, it's a no-brainer, you know, that the European Union works because it brings together 550 million people and the governments of 28 member states in a collegiate way to talk about how best an economic system can work for all of these countries in the best interest of all of those countries. But what it does not do, sets the framework for the development of the economy of the European Union. Mm. It maintains peace within the European Union and all the countries within the Union. But what it does not do is suggest in any way that the cultural spirit or the cultural aspects of each of those individual
Irish
countries has to change. Irish people
aren't going to start becoming German just because of the EU.
And Greek.
But it is an unwieldy thing. I mean, because you've got all these different competing interests, you make, you know, very slow progress by comparison with a nation of homogenous people who kind of all want the same thing. It's obviously, it takes a lot more effort, it takes a lot more trouble, it takes a lot more time.
Yeah.
The benefits necessarily could be very good. But I remember when I was, you know, just paying attention to these things in the late 90s, early 2000s, everyone wanted to be in the EU. There were countries that were just begging to be in from left to right to up and down. And there were furious debates about who was going to be let in and who wasn't. And then suddenly about, 4 years ago, there were a whole lot of countries who suddenly said, well, maybe we want out.
Yes, yeah.
Do you think that that's a frustration with the processes? Do you think it's a frustration with the actual idea of the EU? Because we see, you know, with the British Brexit referendum and everything else, that there are absolutely, and we even hear the French talking about this, and the Spanish and the Italians. And I mean, do you think that the shine has come off slightly? What is it that's made people do an about turn?
Well, I mean, the European Union has been there for quite a long time. And I suppose at any one time, there are issues that boil up. Like migration is the really big issue at the moment, the numbers of migrants that are entering the European Union. And there's been a lot of focus around, you know, the challenges that are created by so many millions of people entering into the European Union. And that's caused a huge amount of tension within the European Union. And, you know, it's been a very difficult issue to handle. You see in Germany, for instance, the way initially there was a welcome to the numbers of migrants coming into the country.
And now there's resistance.
Since then, there's a bit of resistance. And you see that across many different countries in the European Union. But I would suspect that if you had a polls in every one of those countries about whether they wanted to stay in the European Union,
they'd say
yes, because the benefits, and from Ireland's perspective, I mean, the benefits of being part of the European Union have been absolutely extraordinary. I mean, our whole economic development has occurred because of our membership of the European Union. Now, we've made big strides in developing our education system, and that's a national issue, but our economy would not have developed without that access that we've got to the 550 million people market. Now, I think that you're right that very often there's criticism of the slowness of the process of agreeing. You know,
well, people feel, because again, this is maybe to do with a level of ignorance, but people always feel we're paying for two governments effectively, and the one gets things done because it's much more localized. The other one seems to just be this endless stream of bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know, that's how a lot of people feel about it,
I suppose. But again, I don't like talking about other countries, but let me give the example of Ireland. I mean,
do people in Ireland feel that way?
No, absolutely not. But the latest polls in Ireland suggest that, you know, 75 to 80% of the people of Ireland want to stay in the European Union.
Right.
Because we look back, you know, we joined the European Union in 1973, and, you know, we look back to the benefits that we've achieved as a result of that membership. Mm-hmm. In 1973, we were a very poor country, and our whole infrastructural development has occurred because of our membership of the European Union. And that's one of the concepts of the European Union, this spread of wealth, the spread of resources to help the poorer countries or the countries on the outlying parts of Europe, which we are, to develop their infrastructure so that our economies can grow. Because economies do not grow without strong infrastructures. So our road systems, our transport systems, our school systems have all improved immensely.
Yeah, you see, people in South Africa tend to think that the whole of Europe is the same, that everybody in Europe has the same level of infrastructure and education and opportunity and the economies are all performing on some kind of consistent basis. They're obviously not.
No, they're not. No, they're not. I mean, Ireland now is the strongest growing economy in the European Union. I mean, last year we had about 6% growth.
Right.
This year we're already showing higher than that, 6, 7, and some are suggesting even 8% growth. And that's extraordinary levels of growth in the current global context, where there's a lot of talk about protectionism. We have big challenges. I mean, our biggest trading market is the United States.
Right.
Our second biggest market is the United Kingdom. And there, as you know, there are big challenges on the protectionist
side
from the United States and Brexit on the United Kingdom
side.
So the way we are looking at this is to try and manage those relationships in the right way, but also look at different markets now. Mm. So we're opening new embassies in Asia and Africa and different parts of the world, South America, looking at the trade opportunities in those countries so we can provide opportunities for our companies, because we're an export-driven economy. We have to have markets to export our goods to. 85% of what we produce, we export. So we have to have markets to export those goods to. And South Africa is one of those big markets for us.
Well, you talk about South Africa. I mean, this is your current preoccupation, and we're delighted that it is, because you've just given me a very useful and interesting synopsis. And I'm sure many people who've listened to this now will feel that they understand a little bit more about where Ireland's placed in the world. But how are South African and Irish relations, and could they be improved? And what kinds of things are we already doing together? I mean, what should we be proud of that we might not know about?
Relationships can always be improved and always developed. We have a very strong relationship with South Africa. We opened up diplomatic relations with South Africa in 1993, which was after the ending of the apartheid years. We waited until then. And we opened our embassy here in 1994. South Africa opened their embassy in 1995. So we have 25 years of diplomatic relations between the two countries this year.
Amazing.
So we've done a number of things this year. We have the Nelson Mandela exhibition. We've moved part of it from the apartheid museum in Johannesburg to Dublin, to Kilmainham Jail in Dublin, which is one of the iconic museums in Dublin where the leaders of the 1916 rebellion in Dublin were executed by the British. So that exhibition is running for 6 months. But outside of the cultural relationships and the trading relationships, what I'm really interested in is developing the people-to-people relationship.
Mm.
In the latest year for which we have statistics, which is last year, up to about 40,000 people travelled both ways. So with 40,000 Irish people came to South Africa, 40,000 South Africans travelled to Ireland.
By the way, is that a fairly easy thing for Irish people to do, to come here?
Yes, yeah. There's no visa requirement for either way. No visa requirement for Irish people to travel to South Africa, and no visa requirement. We're the only EU member state that does not
have a
visa requirement for South Africans.
This is honestly news to me.
Yeah, and so it makes it's fairly straightforward for South Africans to visit Ireland. But I'm also very interested in the education links, because many doctors in this region, whether it's South Africa, Mauritius, Botswana, have trained in Ireland.
Oh.
I was in Mauritius. I cover five countries. Zimbabwe, Mauritius, Lesotho and Botswana, as well as South Africa. I got a list recently of the doctors living in Mauritius. 75% of them were trained in Ireland.
Hmm.
And now that's dropped quite a lot. So I'm anxious to develop those educational links again. Trading side, a trade of about 1.2 billion euros between the two countries, most of which is coming from Ireland to South Africa. And I'm just keen to get a bit more from South Africa into Ireland.
Sure, certainly.
South African investors, companies investing in Ireland because of the access to the European market, Investec, big investment, employing nearly 500 people in Ireland. Aspen Pharmaceuticals, another South African company. But the most interesting one, I think, is Spar.
Yeah.
The South African Spar chain owned the Irish Spar chain. And very often you're listening to the business news in South Africa and Spar comes up. And the first item they mention is the profitability of the Irish franchise.
So it's done very well.
So it's done really well for a South African company.
Yeah, because South African retail and many other of our sectors are always looking for new markets, and Ireland should be featuring prominently there.
Yeah. But again, another very interesting part of the relationship. I mean, the Irish fought on both sides of the Boer War in 1914. On the British Army side for economic reasons, but on the Boer side because of the colonialism.
The political reasons,
So, and it's amazing the way the country has evolved, or the relationships has evolved since. In 1997, there was a meeting here in Arniston, hosted by Nelson Mandela and Cyril Ramaphosa. They brought over all the leaders of the Northern Ireland conflict, and it's now seen as the most important meeting in setting the minds together to prepare for the Good Friday Agreement, which was agreed in 1998.
Right, between the Ulster Unionists and
the Ulster Unionists and Sinn Féin.
Right.
And so the contribution of Nelson Mandela and Cyril Ramaphosa to that process was absolutely immense. And others within the South African system, Rolf Meyer comes to mind as well. President Ramaphosa was also one of the inspectors in the arms decommissioning process in Northern Ireland. So the current president's, South African president's, knowledge of Ireland is incredible. As a result of all of those, the build-up of all those relationships, Ireland was asked, along with South Africa, to organise the recent Nelson Mandela Peace Summit, took place as part of the UN General Assembly Week in September. And President Ramaphosa delivered the keynote address. Our own Taoiseach, our own Prime Minister, spoke. And they also had their first bilateral. Our own Taoiseach is new.
Right.
He's only in the office about just over a year. And he's under 40. And he's the son of an Indian immigrant and an Irish mother. And is part of the gay family in Ireland. So it's a really big signal of how Ireland has evolved.
Yeah, I mean, that just shows you, and people wouldn't think that if they didn't bother to find out, right? Yeah.
And that bilateral meeting between our Prime Minister and President Ramaphosa has really helped now to move ahead in terms of the relationship between the two countries. So we have our midterm review of our political partnership discussions coming up now in Dublin next month. And we have a high-level delegation coming over from... And that relationship embraces not just trade, it embraces education relationships, science and technology, culture. And we have things happening in all of those areas now. And we've developed a lot of these over the last 4 or 5 years.
How many Irish people live in South Africa? Well, how big is the Irish community in South Africa?
We have 35,000 Irish passport holders living in South Africa. Many of those are South African people that have Irish ancestry and continue to be entitled to the Irish passport, but they're part of the Irish family. We have a very strong Irish association in South Africa with three chapters in Johannesburg, Cape Town and Durban. And regular events, cultural events are organised to celebrate Irishness and what we have achieved over the years and the evolution of Ireland. Like tomorrow I'm opening an exhibition in Cape Town. Which relates to the celebration, continued celebration or the commemoration of the 1916 rebellion. So we have a lot of paintings and graphics of the 1916 leaders and people who lived in that time. But what we've also done is that we've brought in pictures and stories of the Irish anti-apartheid movement and also stories of the way in which the relationship between the two countries has evolved. Mm-hmm. So it's a very significant exhibition, which is something similar to the one that we have in Camanum Jail in Dublin at the moment. So we're now going to have two exhibitions, one in Dublin and one in Cape Town.
Right. It's like a reciprocal situation.
So I'm really pleased that, as I say, we're developing this strong cultural relationship as well.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, people, you mentioned there are a lot of South Africans with Irish ancestry who perhaps have Irish passports. I believe on a list that was published last year, the Irish passport is the most sought after passport in the world. Is that still the case?
It is, I think.
Is that because everybody likes you?
I think everybody likes the Irish passport. I think everybody likes us. Yeah, but everywhere you go in the world, you're going to meet Irish people because of what I said earlier about the immigration.
Yes.
We're a country, and it's not so much, we're not a country of immigration anymore, obviously. We're a country of immigration.
Yes.
Because almost 15% of our people now are immigrants from different countries. And our population has grown from the figure I mentioned earlier of 3.5 million to about 4.7 million now. But on the island of Ireland, which includes the north of Ireland, we have about 6 million people in total. So there are Irish people everywhere in the world.
Well, the American Irish community is huge.
Yeah, it's about 40 million, they say. Yeah.
It could be more Irish than Ireland in some ways. And there are parts of America where you hear, even in the accent, traces of a very strong Irish heritage.
Yeah. And the Irish diplomatic presence, our footprint in the United States is huge. I mean, our embassy is in Washington, but we have consulates in 5 or 6 cities across America for that very reason, to link into the diaspora, which is a big issue for us, making sure that we keep in touch with the Irish diaspora abroad. It's a key value in our foreign policy. But it's also, you know, a lot of these Irish now are top executives in American companies. And it's linking.
We've had a couple of Irish American presidents.
Exactly. Even Barack Obama we managed to figure out some relationship there going back.
Everyone's Irish if you just look far enough into it. Yeah. The other thing about the Irish, the one stereotype I do love, and I'm not sure whether you will or not, but my God, every Irish person I've ever met can drink the rest of us under the table and they still end up standing at the end of it. You have a tolerance like very few people in the world.
I think that's changed as well. I mean, I think we have that reputation of, you know, being good Guinness drinkers.
Reputation? I'll prove it. I'll name individuals.
And we enjoy it. But I think the way Irish people are drinking now has changed now. Even in the pubs, you'll find a lot of pubs now are serving food.
Yeah.
And people are inclined to drink more with food now.
Sure.
And
I'm not saying you're all alcoholics.
We like it. We like to socialise. We work hard. We play hard.
Yeah.
And we like to have our odd drink of Guinness and our odd Jameson. And indeed, you know, Jameson whiskey, the second biggest global market for Jameson whiskey is South Africa.
That's correct.
After the United States. So, we do like to have a lot more wine now. you know. And we got a lot of South African wines.
Do we send a lot of wine?
We got a lot of South African wine in Ireland. But I think it can improve the sales, and that's an objective we have, to try and get more South African wine into Ireland.
So there's been quite a lot of development, positive development between in the relationship between Britain and Ireland, and that wasn't always the case. It was very fractious for a very long time, and no bridges were built, and obviously there were some strides and some inroads made not too long ago, and I remember seeing a whole lot of people like Mo Molum on TV at the time, doing their damnedest to make things happen. And now, of course, things are a lot better, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Much improved. But there's still a little bit of tension. There's still a little bit of residual bitterness and anger after, you know, the troubles, as they call them.
I don't think so. I mean, the troubles were a dreadful period. And 1998, when we had the Good Friday Agreement, that's 20 years ago, was a key moment in the relationship between Ireland and the UK. And since then, I think both governments have worked extremely hard to develop that relationship, to the point now where the UK is Ireland's second biggest trading partner. And Ireland is a very significant trading partner for the United Kingdom.
Sure.
We have what we call a common travel area between the two countries, where there's freedom of movement between the two countries, like there is across the border into Northern Ireland. So I think the relationships have improved immensely since 1998. I mean, I remember travelling in the 1980s through Heathrow Airport, and Irish people never liked travelling through Heathrow Airport. It was always very difficult. But
you were triple searched and you were looked at.
Now it's a much better arrangement. So I think, as you say yourself, the relationship between the United Kingdom and Ireland has developed in a very positive way over the last 20, 25 years in particular. Having said that, you know, because of our history, because of our culture, you know, there's always going to be those small residual issues.
There's going to be pockets.
And sometimes fun can be made of them, you know, like the everyone wants to beat the English kind of thing in rugby or soccer or something like that. So
there are always those people who carry on flying the flag long after everyone else has stopped caring.
Yeah. But I think more broadly, you would find the huge majority of the Irish people see the relationship with the United Kingdom in a very positive light now. And I think it's reciprocated from the British side as well. We work really very closely with the British within the European Union, for instance. So that's why Brexit is a big challenge for all of us. But also more broadly across the globe, you know, in terms of relationships and issues. It's a good relationship. Which has been challenged at the moment, because I'm sure you're going to ask me about this, of Brexit.
The whole Brexit thing. I mean, look, when I was in London in May and in July, it just is the preoccupation of everybody, from people who are cleaning the streets to the people who are running around Westminster. It seems to me that there are a lot of people who are running around like their hair is on fire. Some are saying it's the worst thing that could ever happen. It's a disaster. It's going to plunge people back into the dark ages. And there are other people saying it's a marvelous opportunity and we can't go wrong and this is the best thing ever. I suppose the truth's somewhere in between.
I suppose it is. But the fact is, and what we have
I'm not going to be the one who sparks some kind of international conflict by asking you to get into the details.
Yeah. No, but the fact is, the British have made a sovereign decision to leave the European Union. And whether we like it or not,
we've got to work out the details.
We have to work on that basis.
Poor Theresa May, you wouldn't want her job.
I would not want her job.
Because she doesn't want her job.
It's an extremely difficult, but it's not just a difficult situation for the British government. It's very difficult for Ireland, for the European Union, for the UK. I mean, to get an agreement around all of the issues that we have to agree on to move forward is proving to be very, very challenging. Now, I've seen more recent statements from the President of the European Commission and from the British Prime Minister and from our own Prime Minister that there have been more positive developments. So we're really hoping that some level of agreement can be reached, because there are two key aspects to this. There's the trading relationship with the United Kingdom, because they're one of the biggest trading partners for many countries in the European Union, not just Ireland, but particularly for Ireland. And it's of huge importance to us that the relationship with the United Kingdom going forward, the framework for that is as positive and as open as possible. But the second big challenge, obviously, then is Northern Ireland peace process.
Which is ongoing.
Which is ongoing. And that's the Good Friday Agreement is only 20 years old. You know, and like South Africa, it's only 24, 25 years old.
There's still things, the residual issues that need to be resolved.
And what we don't want to happen is for any sense of a border being recreated, given the progress that has been made.
Even symbolically, it would be bad.
Absolutely. So, and that could give rise to more tensions, and you just don't know how those tensions could manifest themselves over the coming years. So we all have a responsibility to make sure that these discussions produce the right type of solution.
You know, it's interesting. Ireland has also become a fertile ground for all these tech companies to put their massive servers and their data centers into. And obviously, Ireland has been thought of as being one of those territories in which these big tech giants are interested in making massive investments.
Yes.
Is it your experience that that's a growing sector of the economy, or is it starting to level out?
No, it's still growing. I think the level of investment that Ireland gets from the ICT companies, particularly from the United States, is still
Google
huge.
And Facebook and they're all there. Twitter. And,
and it's not just European headquarters. Some of them have their global headquarters based in Ireland.
Well, there's a tax system that can be beneficial too.
The tax system is beneficial, obviously. Our corporate tax system, which is very transparent, is there. And I mentioned that earlier. That was one of the visionary decisions that was made in the 1960s about how we attract investment. But it's not just the friendly environment to attract investment. It's the education system. We produce the skills.
Right. You can hire people there that know what they're doing.
So there's a lot of universities now producing high-level ICT software-based skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the access to the European market, this 550 million people market that I mentioned. We speak English, which is obviously makes life easy for the United States companies.
Some people struggle to understand,
We speak with very different accents, but even within Ireland.
Do you change your accent when you go home?
No.
No, you sound like this no matter where. But there are different accents in
Ireland.
Very much so. I mean, obviously, you could tell if someone's from Cork.
I could tell someone from Cork, from Donegal, from Galway, Kerry. I mean, there are very different accents throughout Ireland, you know, and I marvel still when I meet some Irish people in South Africa after 35 years.
And you can pick
up. They still have their Cork accents.
The regional,
yeah, absolutely. It's incredible that they've kept those accents, which is wonderful. But the Irish people abroad, our diaspora, are hugely important to us. They integrate so well into the communities where they live, but they never lose that Irishness, that willingness to want to be part of the Irish diaspora.
That's a very good point. It's almost a unique case study, because if you think about America and you hear Donald Trump mouthing off against immigrants and all the rest of it, it's interesting that the Irish are able to, as you say, assimilate, but they still keep their identity without being a threat to anyone.
Exactly,
it's a very unique situation. Almost anyone else coming in, people go, get the backs up about these people aren't going to assimilate. They don't seem to have that problem with the Irish.
We don't. I remember when we reviewed our foreign policy a couple of years ago, we had long debates about what our priorities should be. And it was absolutely unanimous, particularly among the diplomats within the system and the politicians, our ministers, and that our relations with the diaspora had to be kept as our number one priority.
Wow.
We've so many Irish people living abroad that were, many of whom are descendants of immigrants that had to leave for economic reasons, that we have a duty of care to those diaspora. But also it can benefit Ireland. You know, I mean, a lot of these diaspora have done well abroad, and some of them, as I mentioned earlier,
some very, very well-known and public personalities.
Exactly.
And
they're contributing to Ireland's development now as well.
Have you found a place that can serve you a decent Irish meal or a proper Guinness here in South Africa, or are they hard to come by?
they're hard to come by. I have to say, the Irish aren't known
for their cuisine,
for their national dishes. We're not. Does, I mean,
this
Irish,
is where you're meant to say, oh no, we've got a thousand things no, that we no, do no, that no, no one else does.
I mean, I think, you know, the Irish breakfast is famous. You know,
sure.
The agri-food sector in Ireland is very successful. But you've asked me, what are the Irish national dishes? I mean, and there's not the Irish stews and, sure. and Irish bacon and cabbage. But what I will say is that Irish cuisine, the cuisine in Ireland has evolved in the same way as the country has evolved. So now we have got superb restaurants, you know, serving wonderful food. And Irish people expect quality now in the same way as any other country. So we have lots of...
I wasn't suggesting we all have cabbage and bacon.
It's very nice, but I remember growing up, we had our Dublin coddle, which is a kind of a white stew, a poor man's stew.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful. I found a dish of that in Hong Kong once in an Irish pub.
Oh, wow.
Serving Dublin coddle. But you very often get Irish stew in the Irish pubs around Pretoria and Johannesburg and Cape Town.
So well you, are you mostly in Pretoria?
I'm based in Pretoria.
Yeah.
But I travel to Johannesburg quite a lot. Most of the Irish business community is based in Johannesburg or Cape Town. So I would travel in here quite a lot or to Cape Town. And the Irish communities are predominantly here in Cape Town and Durban.
Right.
So I go to Durban a bit as well. Pretoria is a bit different. You know, it's the seat of government.
Sure.
It's where all the embassies are based. Mm. But the Irish community there is quite small.
Quite small. Yeah. I heard you say that your house that you stay in now as the ambassador is about four times the size of the house that you had in Ireland. Four or five times, you said.
Did I say that?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot more space, I suppose.
I think, you know, that the residence in Pretoria is owned by the Irish people.
Mm-hmm.
And we use it a lot for entertainment.
Sure, receptions and dinners.
We celebrate St. Patrick's Day there.
What do you do for St. Patrick's Day?
We invite about 400 people to the residence and have a few hours of celebration of Irish culture.
And still standing afterwards?
Still standing afterwards,
well, that's impressive.
And then the Irish Association organize events throughout the country in Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Durban. We also have a big association, Harare, so we try to get up there as well. There are about 1,500 Irish living in Zimbabwe still.
Is it still a very formal thing to be an ambassador? I mean, do you still have to do the balls and the presentations of credentials and all of that stuff? I mean, is it still... Yeah, there's a phone that you have that can get you straight to Ireland, and there's a phone that you can call the South African Diplomatic Department of International Relations. I mean, what's it like? What is the day-to-day stuff?
No, I think, you know, I've come here without a tie.
I've noticed that.
The formalities and the protocols are probably not as stuffy as they used to be, but there are still protocols, and they're important protocols. And an ambassador is appointed to a country. That ambassador is not officially the ambassador until he or she presents the credentials to the head of state.
And of course, you become the interlocutor between the two governments.
Yes,
if our president wants to address some important matter with Ireland, he'll first call on you.
Exactly, yeah, through the foreign ministry here.
Yeah.
So
we've heard in the last couple of weeks, months, there have been a couple of summonses to the president or to the Department of International Relations.
Well, thankfully, we haven't had any big issues. All of our issues have been positive. Like, for instance, the bilateral between our prime minister and the president. We had a lot of contact with the foreign minister here about that. So we're looking for President Ramaphosa to visit Ireland now because of his relationship with Ireland.
Absolutely.
And we're hoping that can take place in the coming year or so. It's been a fantastic posting here. And
how long you still got?
Probably up to next July, August next year. That'll be five years. And that's probably the longest you would get in our system. But I'm happy to do that.
Are you looking to move somewhere else after that? Or would you like to go back home for a little bit?
Go home and probably retire next year. I've got...
You still have work to do. Come on.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, I'm myself and my wife have discussed this, and we've got two grandchildren now. We've got an 11-year-old adopted child that's from Malawi.
Oh, yeah?
So we've two grown-up sons and an 11-year-old that we adopted in Malawi who goes to school in Pretoria. So I need to give some time back
if you've got an 11-year-old, you've still got to keep up the energy and enthusiasm, right?
Like she was 11. We had our 11th birthday party last Saturday, so we had 21 kids at the party. So
Wow.
We're not the normal, you know, 30, no. mid-30s, 40-year-olds anymore.
Did all the other kids' parents come and you sort of felt a bit
but I have
out
to say,
of sorts?
You know, having an 11-year-old child going to a South African school, I mean, the access and that's given us to the parents of those children, the conversations that we've had.
Well, you have real integration into the community,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. It's been fantastic.
Did you adopt her in Malawi when you were there?
Malawi, there, yeah. So she goes to the school here, and we've made great friends of the parents with the other kids in school, and we have play dates, and so it's just a different perspective that it's given us.
It must be quite something for her friends to say, you know, I'm going around to the Irish ambassador's house today, not just my friend's dad.
I think they like that, yeah. No, it's been great, I have to say, and it's one of those aspects of our lives that, you know, is so positive now, having an 11-year-old, but never expected it. My wife always said she wanted a daughter. Now she has.
Now she's got one. Well, that's terrific. Yeah. Thank you for the contribution you're making to the good relations between South Africa and Ireland. It's always nice to meet the people, the principals involved in making these things happen. I didn't realize that you didn't need a visa to go to Ireland, so I think that's a good reason to get onto it immediately. Mm. Love to go there. I haven't been yet, and I've heard only good things from the people who have. Lots of Irish people I know in South Africa are very, very happy to be here and to contribute to South Africa and simultaneously to be as Irish as can be. Mm. So it's quite a lovely overlap of magisteria, which I think makes a lot of people feel like they belong, you know, in two different places, and they can at the same time.
No, absolutely.
Will you come back and visit if you're not ambassador anymore?
No, I think I would, absolutely. I mean, it's an extraordinary country. I think, you know, I'm looking forward in my last year here now just to do a bit more travelling within South Africa, just to see more of that beauty before we leave.
Well, Ambassador McGann, thank you so much for talking to us. It's an absolute pleasure to see you today.
Okay, thanks very much, Grant.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right.
This is CliffCentral.com.